disclaimer. As we will see, the story of the City of London Corporation begins much earlier than 1948. But some developments brought about the very year were decisive to how the story continued and accelerated in subsequent years. So it was not with immediate effect, but over the course of the 20th century. In the midst of dynamics in 1948, for the first time, the norms of the computer's architecture, computing systems, and information theory are constituted. But also, and no less importantly, as historian Quinn Slobodian shows in his forthcoming book titled Globalists, the year 1948 was the year the human right of capital flight, that's how it's called, was enshrined. What we tend to call proxy politics is grafted upon these four columns just mentioned and relies on their continual performance and expansion as a motor and disguise. It was from the late 1940s onwards, with the emergence of cybernetic systems, that the mix of the infrastructure, theory and design created a real virtuality for trade and tax evasion. Juridical domains potentially developed into virtual domains, and juridical abstractions would later on be able to cloak themselves under a new metaphor, the World Wide Web.
Hi. So, as many of you might remember, less than a month ago, a trove of some 13 million confidential electronic documents found their way to the Süddeutsche Zeitung. Actually, they found their way to the newspaper already in late 2016, but it took a year or more to process them. And from the newspaper, they continued or were relayed to the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. This was a massive leak, yet another one, in what seems now to be a sinking yacht riddled with holes. The aptly named Paradise Papers, therewith maybe hinting at the fictitious qualities of tax havens that we will come to later, those Paradise Papers tell a story of a fall from grace. The release is an emphatic reminder of the close relation between growing inequality and elaborate tax evasion schemes set on a global scale, which might be symptomatic of increasingly opaque maneuvers of the powers that be. But how did we get here? Where can one trace the origin of this offshore world? Our story begins today in London, where recent debates around sovereignty and the lack thereof have focused on the authority vested upon the EU or upon EU institutions by the Union's member states. But London has actually always had quite a complex relationship towards sovereignty. And as we shall see, it could be said to have provided a medieval template, so to speak, to what's rapidly becoming the 21st century preferred modes of authority.
The old sages used to say of Jerusalem that it is plural, doubled, a city above, which is divine, boundless, eternal almost, and a city below, earthly, profane, and bound by matter, bricks and mortar. London, too, is doubled, displaced, present and absent at the same time. It has multiple maps. Let's visit the London below and have a look at New Bond Street, which runs perpendicular to Oxford Street, traversing it from north to south. On your right, number 98, stands a three-story townhouse, white, simple, unassuming, and currently home to luxury fashion brand Philip Plain. Now open your map of the other London, the one that hovers above and beyond. You will see that from this townhouse, you're in fact in Barbados. This particular property was purchased in 2010 for nearly £4.5 million by New Bond Property Limited, a company registered in an independent nation state within the British Commonwealth. Let's continue our journey. Walk down New Bond Street to your right, number 135, another three-story high building, built in stone this time. It is the home of luxury brand Belstaff. In London below, this is a massive Victorian building furnished with marble columns and antique bronze cage chandeliers rooted in the ground. And above, it is all liquidity, an asset temporarily stowed on the Marshall Islands. By Lincoln Estate Limited, which meanwhile might have been dissolved, our source, we are very indebted to, is called, it's the Private Eye magazine, and they did research on property ownership in London, or in the whole UK, actually, until 2014. So further up New Bond Street are the auction houses, Christie's and Bonham's, but these buildings, too, are only partially present. Their spirit and lifeblood lies elsewhere, stashed in the British Virgin Islands or the Isle of Man. Profits are nomadic. Expenses tend to be sedentary. Corporations transfer profits by setting the price for goods and services sold between controlled or related legal entities within a single enterprise. In this way, funds are channeled to offshore subsidiaries in low to no tax jurisdictions. An arrangement known until recently as a double Irish, often combined with a Dutch sandwich. While tax-deductible expenses are conveniently conserved onshore. The corporations that use these principles are household names, from Nike to Facebook, Google, or Amazon. London above, as we can already see, is a web in constant flux facilitated by law firms and trust companies. The web's territorial spread must outwit what laws and regulations might come into place.
But how did the City of London Corporation, or formerly also known as the Corporation of London, how does the City of London Corporation and its organizational form come to prefigure contemporary modes of governance? The history of the city is as complex as and convoluted as its structure. Some would say this archipelago is a thousand years old, founded by the Romans and called Londinium. Its foundations can be traced back to at least to 1067, when the City of London Corporation is first mentioned in a royal charter. Though actually, this is purely, this is only the first mention of the City of London. It's not the charter of incorporation. So it is safe to assume it existed before. With the 1690 Act of Parliament, there was a confirmation of all the privileges of the Corporation of London through the declaration by the mayor that the commonalty and citizens of the city should remain, continue, and be and prescribe to be a body corporate and politic in re facto e nomine. You could also trace its ascent as the financial capital of the 21st century to its commanding role within the British Empire and its web of crown dependencies, including Jersey, Guernsey, the Isle of Man, and the British overseas territories. So the corporation is the oldest local authority in the United Kingdom and has an unusually wide range of responsibilities. But it lacks a charter of incorporation or any specific date of establishment. It is believed to have evolved organically from earlier bodies. It is a sui generis mode of governance above, before, and beyond law and state. A hybrid of medieval custom, absolutist obscurity, and 21st century technological prowess. The British Parliament has little authority over the corporation. On the contrary, an official lobbyist dubbed This is the official lobbyist, dubbed, there you go. That's a bit too early. So, dubbed the Remembrancer, is appointed by the corporation and permanently stationed in both the House of Commons and the House of Lords to ensure the elected representatives will never compromise the corporation's interests, i.e., the interests of the financial class. His name is Paul Double. The city also has a unique form of democratic rule, whereby city businesses, which far outnumber its human residents, can register and vote. To become an elected representative within the corporation, you must first be a freeman of the City of London. To become a freeman, you have to be approved by the aldermen. And for the aldermen to approve you, you need to belong to one of the city's many livery companies. Guilds such as the Worshipful Company of Costermongers, Fletchers, and Horners. Though mainly, the main point is that to be eligible for any of these positions, one has to have quite a lot of cash.
Home to an immense concentration of international wealth, the city has become synonymous with an opaque, globally connected financial elite, nested within a feudal boys' club, keyword gentleman capitalism, whose members nowadays do not mind traveling in golden coaches and wear red robes with fur collars at ceremonies. Last but not least, a more recent chapter in the City of London Corporation's elusive history began in the 1950s, when from the ashes of the British Empire and facing the uncertain fate of the pound, there emerged an unlikely savior in the form of the euro dollar and its corollary, the euro market. Euro markets, also known as xeno markets, are markets in which banks deal in a currency other than their own. During the 1950s, their development enabled the euro dollar to become the de facto international currency. Since these markets do not affect the sovereign internal money supply, their regulation tends to be lax and their interest rates high, resulting in a liberal and thus potentially toxic loan market. This market and its, I quote, spin-offs that ultimately forced through the liberalization of the world economy, whether the world's citizens liked it or not. The USSR, perhaps unwittingly, was in the vanguard of this increasing financialization. At the brink of the Cold War, the Soviet Union was wary of leaving its dollars in the US for fear that they might be confiscated if the conflict between the two countries was to escalate. As a precaution, the Russians decided to transfer these funds offshore to the City of London, where in 1957 they deposited several hundreds of thousands of dollars in the local branch of the Moscow Narodny Bank. The Bank of England looked the other way. The money quickly piled up. It wasn't long before Wall Street joined the party. By 1959, $200 million were deposited in the freshly instituted euro market, and by 1960, it had reached a billion.
Now, a decade later, the world was already awash in offshore foreign currency markets, with nodes established from the Caribbean to landlocked Luxembourg. Gradually, onshore came to resemble offshore, with governments pushed towards further deregulation by the looming threat of capital drainage. From now on, states would have to compete with special economic zones sprouting across the globe, with the authority of central banks increasingly limited by the power of these newly founded xeno markets. Capital had new leverage over local policy. Journalist Nicholas Shackson, author of the book Treasure Islands, Tax Havens and the Men Who Stole the World, summarizes why London has become so attractive for foreign money. It is secrecy, domicile rule, and the lack of legal jurisdiction, as well as the right for corporations to vote. Votes which, as we mentioned, outnumber the people living in the City of London fourfold. These proxy politics of people blending into systems and costumes have fueled the global economy, where the Delaware, Freeport, nation states, anonymous trusts, shell companies, Mossack Fonseca or Appleby, among others, are treated as equal entities, with these acts of depoliticizing and cover-ups resulting in what Hito Steil has termed netscapes that are partly unlinked from geography and national jurisdiction.
Now we reach the year 1986. In 1986, the Big Bang, which means or stands in a nutshell for the moment that state control of money flows and the separation between saving banks and investment banks were abolished. So it means total deregulation, and the City of London Corporation called it a fiscal revolution. So this revolution was spearheaded by Margaret Thatcher, where, in fact, only chiming with the changes brought about by the institutions of the euro market. Stock trading moved from noisy phone calls to silent electronic screens and humming servers. The internet, with its ostensible placelessness, is the perfect medium for such a regime. Places are deemed virtual, and thus a registered office in the Caymans can be as real as one in the midst of the city, or as unreal as a domain name registered under KY, the Cayman Islands' top-level domain address. Ronan Palin, a British professor for international politics, described tax havens as making use of fictional relocation, a mystery tool that promoted the transformation of sovereign rights into a marketable product. National boundaries are thus expanded into the imaginary spaces of jurisdiction, delimiting forms of intangible property rights. There are literally remains of the London City Wall integrated in the basement of the Merrill Lynch Bank building in King Edward Street. The leftovers of the medieval wall appear caged, even though the bank's business is built on jurisdictions dating back to the times these walls were built. Like the wall, a relic now incorporated into the bowels of the bank, sovereign rule, too, seems to have been relinquished to the man of the city. Any external overview of its financial institutions is severely limited. Unlike any other financial center in the world, the City of London Corporation relies on a method of self-regulation.
So let's return for a moment to the streets and buildings where the deterritorialized system materializes and reterritorializes. Ugland House in South Church Street on the Cayman Islands is a building that in April 2016, with the release of the Panama Papers, the last leak, so to speak, made the news as a landmark and grotesque manifestation of this shadow economy. 20,000 firms call it home, using its name and address as their own. The Cayman Islands, just like the city it is modeled after and linked to, has more registered companies than inhabitants. One can imagine much of the profit made on New Bond Street in London is channeled into the Ugland House, linked by an invisible umbilical cord or maybe an undersea cable. The connection surfaces sporadically, a leak here, a lawsuit there. But this is obviously just the tip of the iceberg, a symbolic step into transparency. Mostly they just hide behind the tinted window shades or move houses to continue on with the same dealings with their opaque business. To come back to our initial question, what can this tale of the City of London teach us about the world we live in? As political theorist Maurice Glasman puts it, the city is an ancient and very small intimate relational institution which doesn't really fit into anyone's preconceived paradigm of modernity. It's a medieval commune representing capital. It just simply does not compute. And indeed, the City of London Corporation, which with its arcane customs and silly costumes, is not the first thing one would imagine as the vanguard of the 21st century global capitalism. But what if modern analytical frameworks aren't adept for understanding our current political and economic regime? Perhaps the secret to the city's success lies in having anticipated the prevalent mode of governance. In more than one sense, we now live in a world designed by the city and its ilk, which have created a world in which democratic rule is reduced to a mere semblance, just another empty shell. Should one still call this form capitalism? As Sheldon Wolin has written, our contemporary economy of powerful multinational corporations resembles nothing so much as the warring states of 16th century Italy. Are we therefore in the midst of the advent of a feudal industrial regime stimulated by accelerated commerce and an exasperated state? The City of London Corporation is symptomatic of the rise of the city-state and waning state sovereignties.
Competing velocities make this object of analysis elusive. Every attempt to end this talk with a full stop triggers another aspect, unfolds another layer, and introduces another story, another leak. To speak in pictures when staring at the city, it appears like a fractal image in five dimensions, progressively revealing new details and endlessly recurring patterns. Is archipelago capitalism a 21st century spin-off of the feudal age, or something entirely different? Whatever it may be, the genesis of the City of London Corporation invites us to reconsider our recent history. Perhaps it was 1957, the year euro markets were born, rather than 1989, that signaled the impending collapse of a bipolar world split between two superpowers. It wasn't the end of history. Instead, it was a stealthy Big Bang that spawned a lengthy process of expansion and dislocation, perforating states with financial zones and secrecy jurisdictions, and overwhelming the world with cheap credit and new debt. It seems we have been afloat ever since, drifting in an offshore world. The question is, will these islands survive the large-scale leaks?
Thank you.
Und ist denn dieser Big?